Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Kelly Goff, a columnist for The Daily Beast and a regular contributor and guest host for the show. Josh Barrow is away this week. Today, we're doing things a little differently. Instead of our usual roundtable, we're having in-depth conversations with experts on some of the defining political topics in the news that we usually aren't able to devote more than a segment to. We'll be starting with a conversation with Geraldo Calava, an expert on Hispanic voters, as our country celebrates Hispanic Heritage Month. Then we'll talk to Gloria Felt on the latest fights over abortion in Texas and how her years running Planned Parenthood Federation of America prepared her for her current battle to increase the representation of women in leadership roles. But first up, Hispanic voters are being credited with playing a decisive role in a recent major Democratic victory, but our next guest will explain why the facts are more complicated. So today we have one of the country's leading experts on Hispanic voters, Geraldo Calava. Geraldo is a professor of history at Northwestern University, and his most recent book is called The Hispanic Republican, The Shaping of an American Political Identity from Nixon to Trump. Thanks so much for joining us, Geraldo.
And thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, I want to start right here in California because there's a column out in the Los Angeles Times by Jean Guerrero, which argues that Latino voters helped save Gavin Newsom in the recall, and their support for him proves the curtain on Trumpism is closing and bodes well for Democrats in upcoming midterms. I should say that I'm a Texas native, and that might come up more than once today because Texas has been in the news quite a bit for lots of reasons.
But I think
a lot of people see California and Texas as somewhat similar, particularly when it comes to disputes over immigration. So I was really fascinated by your piece for The New Yorker, which affirms there is no universal narrative when it comes to the politics of Hispanics in America, particularly in 2021. And so just a point of clarification, your article notes that among many of your subjects, there is a preference for the term Hispanic. So I'm going to try to stick to that during our conversation. but let me just read some data really quickly just so our listeners have an idea of the data points you're referring to. According to the Washington Post, in 2016, Hillary Clinton won, in most cases by a large margin, almost every county in the southernmost tip of Texas and along the border. But in 2020, the margin shrank and President Trump flipped several previously reliable Democratic counties in the same region. A lot of those counties were predominantly Hispanic. That's the point of the data. Democratic margins improved in 25 of the 34 state legislative districts that were contested in both 2012 and 2020, though some districts in the primarily Latino Rio Grande Valley, which historically has been a Democratic stronghold, took huge steps to the right in 2020. And the last data point that's definitely worth a mention is while President Biden won Hispanic and Latino voters by 33 percentage points nationwide, according to exit polls from Edison Research, that number was slashed in half in Texas. Why is it that Hispanics in Texas are leading such explosive growth for the GOP there?
If you were to ask Latino Republicans that question, they would say that it has to do with the increasing conservatism among Latinos. And in particular, the people I've talked to point to the kind of cultural conservatism of rural working class Mexican Americans. It has a lot to do with salesmanship and posturing right now as a kind of post facto interpretation of the 2020 results. So they too were kind of surprised by the results. And I'm talking about Latino Republicans. They too were kind of surprised by the results in Texas. But they do believe that the Democratic Party is just out of touch with Latinos. This is what they say. They say that, especially among immigrants, they think that Democrats just fundamentally misunderstand the ambitions of Latin American immigrants. And they think that Latin American immigrants don't come to the United States to be lumped together with other Latinos as part of a large American minority group. They think they come here to provide for their families, to provide better educational opportunities for their kids. So Latino Republicans believe that the Democratic Party, by focusing so obsessively on issues of race and ethnic identity and immigration as the one issue that Latinos care about, they think they're, you know, the Democrats are just making a huge error in doing that.
I find that fascinating. And I will say that one of the things that kept coming up is this idea of the individual versus the community, right? Which is what you're speaking to a bit. And I'm fascinated by this idea because I would say that I think I can't speak for every African-American, but I certainly do believe that there is this idea and this sort of pressure that you put the community first, right? Whether it's in your business decisions, it's in your political calculations. And yet, I have also been very clear that I think that I live for the day where, as an African-American voter, I'm targeted as a swing voter instead of being seen as largely part of a monolith. Can you speak to why it is that historically Hispanic voters have seemed to have voted less as a monolith and certainly have been perceived as less of a monolith than other voters of color have been?
I can certainly try. And I want to say...
And that's a big question.
Yeah, these are really big questions and they're hugely important. And I also, you know, still believe that they're hugely understudied and misunderstood. I mean, I think the quick, easy explanation is to try to put Latinos together in any voting group together as believing the same thing. And with Latinos, you know, I think the first thing to understand is that they are just a hugely, hugely diverse group of voters. And I recognize that there's even some tension in calling them a group of voters because I'm not 100% convinced that they are. But I think that to the extent that politicians recognize Latino diversity, it has to do primarily with their national background. So I think politicians are aware that there are Cubans, that there are Puerto Ricans, that there are Mexican Americans. But I don't think they pay attention to the differences between rural and urban voters or Catholics and evangelicals or folks who've been citizens of the United States for a long, long period of time versus those who might have just naturalized in the months before the election and were voting for the first time. Also, huge generational gap. So I think all of these things point to just really big differences in Latino communities across the country. And I think the Texas-California comparison is really interesting because I think there's a way in which voters in the Rio Grande Valley are more like Mexican-American or other Latin American immigrant, Latin American but naturalized Latinos in the Central Valley of California. So there's a more like rural to rural comparison there than Latinos in the Rio Grande Valley are compared with Latino voters in Houston or Dallas or other big cities. So likewise, I think that in California, you know, voters in the Central Valley, agricultural workers, they might be more closely related to voters in the Rio Grande Valley than they are to Latinos in Los Angeles and San Francisco. And so I just don't think that politicians and most Americans, for that matter, have a really good appreciation for all of the ways in which Latino voters and Latino communities are diverse.
It's really interesting because even among Black immigrants, there tended to be more conservatism. And a lot of the things that came up were, it's exactly what you're talking about, which is I came here to work hard, to pull myself up by my bootstraps, and I'm not interested in hearing people complain that they're incapable of doing the same thing. But I'm assuming that the, but the numbers, in terms of the majority of Black voters, as you know, it tends to be descendants of slaves. So there's a difference there. I do want to say, though, that in preparing for this interview, I found something that I found fascinating and disturbing, which was a memo that was sent to Gerald Ford's campaign about Hispanic voters.
Oh, yeah.
And it was sent to Ford's campaign deputy chairwoman in 1976. And it said Latinos were different from one another and even more importantly, that they differed from African-American voters. Latinos could be played off against the Negroes to break the monolithic low-class mass that voted Democrat.
Yeah, those are some inflammatory words, huh?
Yes, but it's very interesting because I think that, as you know, inflammatory, incendiary, and gross as that language is, the reality we get to see is that Hispanic voters are not seen as a monolith, right? And therefore, I think the parties make more of a concerted effort to not just turn them out as voters, but to convince them to vote for individual candidates, which I think is what every citizen deserves, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, but on that note, I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more about the specific issues that you think are driving Hispanic voters in the Rio Grande Valley, some of the parts of our country that are most impacted by debates over immigration. What is driving them, not just to the GOP, but to Donald Trump specifically? Because I think that's what's fascinating, is that how many of them did not vote for Trump the first time around. And even though Biden won, they did, an increasing number of them did vote for Trump the second time around.
The very first thing I would say is that, you know, the whole Trump presidency was in many ways, when it comes to Latinos, a kind of split screen reality. The on the one side of the screen, what was being shown on all of the news stations and on Twitter and everywhere else were his kind of anti-immigrant statements about Mexicans, rapists, murderers and thieves, those kinds of things. And all the Muslim ban stuff, just a real kind of strong anti-Latino, anti-immigrant, xenophobic message. The other side of the split screen that Americans saw less of was the real concerted effort from even the earliest days of his presidency to court Latinos. And it was persistent, and it did not end in the 4 years that he was in office. So he spoke at a group called the Latino Coalition. This is a kind of nonpartisan group in name officially, but you know, the people who show up to this meeting are all business-owning Republicans. And Donald Trump or Mike Pence spoke at every single one of their annual conferences between 2017 and 2020. And the message was this kind of strong free enterprise slash business regulations, help create loans for Latino business owners so their businesses can thrive. Donald Trump talked all the time about how good his economy was doing for Latino family incomes were up. You know, rates of poverty and unemployment were down. Home ownership was up. And this is the message they really wanted to carry into the 2020 reelection campaign. That got sidetracked by COVID for sure. And that's, I think, when the Trump campaign started turning more to this kind of culturally divisive message instead of the kind of strength of the economy message. So I think, you know, the important point is that the Trump campaign really was making an effort with Latinos. And we're talking Latino homeowners, business owners, not just the immigrant rights crowd. They were really working to court those voters ever since they first set foot in office. And I think they were doing the same thing with charter schools and education. I mean, look at where the fastest growing charter schools are. They are in the Rio Grande Valley. They're in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. They're in California. They're in Arizona, places with large Latino populations. And a majority of Latinos favor charter schools.
African-Americans, too. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and, you know, I think we need to, Democrats need to dig into this a little more, because I think the fact that African-Americans and Latinos support charter schools at such great rates, it has to do with their sincere belief that public schools have not served them. And I think Democrats have to really engage that. And then the final thing is religion. I mean, the Trump campaign made Latino evangelical churches in Florida, Nevada, Arizona, targets from very early on. So I just want it to be understood that at the same time that Trump was saying all the things he was saying about immigrants, his campaign was also making a concerted effort to reach out to Latinos in a way that the Biden campaign never really did.
Well, but the other thing you're touching upon, Geraldo, is that I think that there has long been a bit of a, I know there's a word characterization, but I'm going to say caricaturization in terms of what a minority conservative looks like, right?
Yeah.
And I think that for a long time there was a focus, particularly in the African-American community, on people who are homophobic and anti-gay rights, without spending enough time and energy researching the other issues that they were also considered, quote, conservative on, like charter schools, right? Mm-hmm. And so, and to your point, there's a lot of parallels there where you can track local races where Republicans did decent with the Black community, even Chris Christie in New Jersey, to your point, back in the day, because of issues like that. And so just to quickly follow up on that, how do you think the Biden administration is doing now in comparison to Trump's outreach that you're referring to stay engaged with Hispanic voters? Do you think that they learned from some of the numbers where they dropped off in terms of the election? How do you think they're doing policy-wise on some of this stuff?
I think that they have learned some things, yes. I think that in terms of cabinet officials, Biden appointed a Latino Secretary of Education. who was the superintendent of schools, I believe, in Connecticut. And, you know, that kind of gesture, appointing Latino cabinet secretaries, that has always been a signal by presidential administrations about how Latinos or any other group whose representative is the secretary. It's a signal to those groups that this administration prioritizes them. So I think that's largely symbolic, but it also means something because it's a kind of statement of priorities. I also think that Biden came into office and did immediately start reversing some of the most damaging immigration policies put in place by Trump. But as we know now, he kept in place Title 42, which I was just listening to Alejandro Mayorkas. He was talking about the continued use of Title 42, and he was very adamant in insisting that that's a CDC public health measure and not an immigration measure. But the fact is, Title 42 has been used for the past year to bar the entry of immigrants. And, you know, in many ways, the kind of deportations we're seeing under the provisions of Title 42 have kind of cast a shadow over Biden when it comes to immigration. And I think that immigrant rights activists in particular are extremely frustrated that the administration hasn't acted sooner and more aggressively on the issue of immigration.
Can I ask you a quick question just as a point of clarification? Because one of the things that was popping up in my research, because like I said, I was so fascinated that the growth of Hispanic conservatives seems to be happening largely along the border, is the role of how many Hispanics are actually employed by Border Patrol, ICE, Homeland Security.
Yeah.
So is that perhaps where the conflict is, right? Whereas there are activists saying, we're so disappointed that President Biden, frankly, continued the policies of President Obama, right, which was fairly high deportations. Uh-huh. But there are other Hispanics who are saying, I live along the border. I want people to do it legally, and I want it to feel safer, and I don't feel safer when there aren't as many deportations.
Yes, totally. I mean, I think that the different opinions and beliefs about immigration among Latinos is a really important driver of the conflict. And yes, I can tell you that that is something that Democratic pollsters and strategists are extremely worried about, because what they're worried about is if it seems like Latinos actually don't care that much about immigration, or at least that they're not really united on immigration, then what incentive do Democratic lawmakers really have to push for reform?
Wow.
Because it's already such a polarizing issue. So they're really worried. I mean, and I think, honestly, that this is where part of the impulse for wanting to see Latinos as a united front and that we have power in numbers, this is part of where it comes from, is because Democratic strategists are worried that if there appear to be any chinks in the armor, then there is no armor, and that, you know, lawmakers on Capitol Hill aren't going to pay attention to Latinos.
Let's take a quick break. I've been speaking with Geraldo Cadava of Northwestern University. We'll be back to talk more after this break. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our Left, Right, and Center, and we want to hear from you, too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Support for Left, Right, and Center comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switch to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/LRC. That's odoo.com/LRC. Odoo, modern management made simple.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Kelly Goff, a columnist for The Daily Beast and a regular contributor on Left, Right, and Center. My special guest today is Geraldo Cadava of Northwestern University, and we've been talking about his research about Hispanic and Latino voters. Here's more of our conversation. When people have been writing about the demographics changing in places like Texas, especially with immigration from other states like California, the whole argument was this state is within one election cycle of flipping and becoming blue because of the changing demographics. Yep. And then I read your data And it basically, to me, the headline was not so fast. The demographics are changing, but the politics in this state may not change the way people have been predicting for the last 10 years. Is that correct?
I think that's accurate. I mean, look, Republicans still have a lot to worry about. I mean, for the past 50 years, somewhere between 20, 40, maybe 44% of Latinos have voted for the Republican Party. And only once or twice has it happened that that number has approached 40. So, you know, the more common average is between a quarter and a third of the Latino vote. Now, that's not great news for Republicans, for a group that is, you know, constantly growing and forming more and more of the American electorate, you know, consistently winning maybe 30 or 40% of the Latino vote when we know that Latinos are going to keep playing an important role in politics. That's nothing to get really excited and do somersaults about. I mean, over time, you will consistently lose elections if that's all you win. And that's why I think that Republicans are turning to increasingly nasty practices of voter restriction and kind of trying to lower the number of voters who participate in elections. So I think that's part of what's going on. And, you know, Republicans haven't won. I think they've won one popular election in the 21st century. I mean, that too is nothing to get really excited about. So yes, Republicans have a lot of work to do. And Democrats, you know, they'll dismiss the 25 to 33% of Latinos who vote for Republicans by saying, like, look, 25, 33%, that doesn't win elections. That is also true. But if I were a Democrat, I wouldn't rest so comfortably thinking that Republicans weren't actually gaining momentum and making inroads. I think I would worry more than Democrats seem to be worrying about that possibility.
Can I say something, though? Former President George W. Bush received 44% of the Hispanic vote and did better than any GOP candidate in recent history, even though Senator John McCain actually made creating a pathway to citizenship one of his signature issues. It actually really hurt him with his party. What was the difference in terms of why George W. Bush was able to build such support among that community and someone like McCain and other GOP candidates weren't able to replicate that?
The first thing to note is that the Bush family, and not just George W. Bush, but going all the way back to the family patriarch, George H.W. Bush, and of course, George W. Bush's brother, Jeb, all of them had been waging a concerted campaign to recruit Latino voters for, gosh, 25 years by the time that George W. Bush won the presidency. So George H.W. Bush, you know, he had been a congressman in Texas. He was the chairman of the RNC when the Republican National Hispanic Assembly and the Spanish-speaking caucus of the RNC was founded, and he had helped do that. He very much supported it. Jeb had campaigned for George H.W. Bush in Puerto Rico when Bush was running against Reagan for the 1980 primary. And then, of course, Jeb became a political player in his own right in Florida. So, you know.
And his wife is Mexican. We should add that, too.
And his wife is Mexican. Yeah, Jeb's wife is Mexican. Right. So, Columba Bush. So, you know, the Bush family had done a lot. I think also in the late 90s, when George W. Bush became the nominee for the Republican Party, by that point, much of the 90s had been one long backlash against the Republican Party for its increasingly harsh immigration policy. So like Proposition 187 in California, which many states across the country wanted to mimic, or the kind of harsh 1996 Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act, IRIRA. These are bills that were largely seen as anti-immigrant bills. And so I think George W. Bush in 1998, when he became the nominee, was really seen as a breath of fresh air, the kind of antidote that the Republican Party needed to these kind of punitive immigration measures. So I think 1998, 1999, it was a really different moment than 2008 when John McCain won, when, you know, there was a big backlash against immigrants. Yes, Muslims after 9/11 were primarily the targets, but I think there was a huge intersection between anti-Muslim and anti-Latin American politics, because, you know, you had a governor of Texas like Rick Perry talking about how terrorists could be carrying missiles across the U.S.-Mexico border. So I just think the climate in 2007, 2008 was vastly different than it was in 2000. And John McCain, in some of his kind of, after he lost in 2008, he, you know, kept his Senate career going and was making commercials that said, like, build the dang fence. You know, he kind of fell in line with the anti-immigrant fervor in the Republican Party, and that's kind of continued to today.
Well, before we wrap, let's talk about the future for a bit and talk specifically about elected officials. I remember a moment where a lot of people assumed that there would be a Hispanic vice president or president, frankly, before a black one. I certainly had that conversation, including with African Americans in politics. That was kind of one of the assumptions.
Yeah.
And that has not happened yet. And I even remember a few years ago when Susana Martinez, the then governor of New Mexico, was being touted as, you know, the future of the GOP, and she tangled with Trump. So why do you think there has not yet been a Hispanic American elected president or vice president? And how optimistic are you that there will be one elected sooner rather than later?
I mean, let's see. You know, there have been plenty of Hispanics who've run for president, but they've never made it out of the primary. So it's never really been tested whether a Latino candidate can win on a national stage. And people like Ben Fernandez, who ran in 1980, or Bill Richardson, who ran in the 1990s, or Marco Rubio, or Julian Castro. So, you know, these are people who didn't do particularly well in the primaries. And there has been a lot of suspicion about whether one Latino could appeal to other Latinos who came from different national backgrounds.
So, oh, that's interesting.
Yes, Marco Rubio might have strong support among Cuban Americans in Florida, or Puerto Ricans on the island, or, and again, you know, I know that Puerto Ricans don't vote in the general election, but they do participate in the primary process. And just like there were questions about Julian Castro, about whether his appeal as a Latino candidate would kind of carry over. I think there's also, just as there was with Obama, you know, there were always questions dogging him about to what extent he was an African-American candidate and to what extent was he just an American candidate. And we know that during his campaigns, he in many ways tried to downplay the issue of race and only spoke powerfully about race when he felt like he had to, like during the Jeremiah Wright controversy. And I think that a Latino candidate would face the same exact problem of whether they should run as a Latino. You know, you had Donald Trump, just to give you one example. You had him in New Mexico at a rally in Albuquerque, kind of shouting up to the audience to one of his loyal Latino supporters, Steve Cortez, saying, you know, hey, Steve, who do you love more, Hispanics or Americans? As though those were two entirely different things. So I think there's still, I don't know how widespread it is, but I think there's still the suspicion that Hispanics, Latinos are foreigners and they're fundamentally not Americans. And I think as long as that idea persists in the United States, it'll be really hard for a Latino candidate to get elected. But then on the other hand, we know that Latino representation in politics is in fact growing. I think a few years ago, the Republican bullpen of younger Latino candidates was maybe a little stronger than Democrats, but I think that is also changing. So I think there are a lot of Republicans, a lot of Democrats who could make really good candidates. It seems like AOC is at the head of that pack right now, but we'll see who else comes up behind her. So I guess I am optimistic that, you know, it is only a matter of time just because of the way demographics are changing. And you know, I don't know if it's going to happen in 2024 or 2028, but I think it'll happen sometime in my lifetime.
Geraldo Cavada, it's been such a pleasure. And obviously, this is a topic that is important every month, not just Hispanic Heritage Month. But we are so glad you joined us today.
Thank you so much. It was really nice talking to you.
Let's take a break here and I'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Left, Right and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Kelly Goff, columnist for The Daily Beast and a regular contributor to Left, Right, and Center. As someone who has been covering abortion and reproductive access for many years, I've been following the news about the new abortion laws in Texas closely. And while I've interviewed many, many pro-choice and pro-life activists on this topic over the years, today I wanted to talk to Gloria Felt. Gloria is the founder and president of Take the Lead, whose mission is to achieve gender parity in leadership across all sectors by 2025. She spent 30 years with Planned Parenthood Federation of America, including serving as its president and CEO for 9. A best-selling author, her latest book is called Intentioning: Sex, Power, Pandemics, and How Women Will Take the Lead for Everyone's Good. Gloria, thanks so much for joining us.
Kelly, thank you for having me.
So I want to start with the most obvious question regarding what's in the news. Like me, you're a Texas native, and you actually began your career with Planned Parenthood in Texas. What was your reaction to the news that these new anti-abortion laws in Texas were taking effect? And I'm referring to, for our listeners who do not know, the whole women's health law that makes abortion illegal after 6 weeks, before most women even know that they're pregnant, and also allows those who help women obtain abortions to be sued. But I should also add that just days ago, Texas Governor Greg Abbott signed Senate Bill 4, which blocks anyone except physicians from providing pregnant people with abortion-inducing drugs. And that law takes effect on December 2nd, and it bars physicians from providing the medication for those who are more than 7 weeks pregnant, as opposed to the 10-week limit that was approved by the FDA. So those are the laws we're talking about. What was your reaction when you heard about them?
I wasn't surprised, Kelly. I have to say that this is challenging for me to get back into the mode of talking about these issues, because I have so deliberately started focusing on what I think is really the solution, because we're going to keep fighting these battles over and over again until women have equal power, equal pay, and equal leadership positions. And that's all there is to it. I'm not surprised. It's been a slippery slope, I guess they would say. Frankly, ever since the Webster decision started chipping away at reproductive rights, it's really important for people to understand that the whole issue of reproductive rights and the jurisprudence of reproductive rights are founded in what is not written in the Constitution. It is a right to privacy that has been used to decide many different kinds of cases. And that if and when Roe goes, so goes the right to contraception. That will fall, and so goes the right to for LGBTQ people to have equal rights under the Constitution. So this is much bigger and much broader than abortion. The whole issue is really about power, who has it, who holds it, who wields it, what they do with it. And we need to be very clear about that. We need to stop arguing on a narrow basis and force the conversation to be where it needs to be, which is about women's human and civil rights to make their own childbearing decisions.
You referenced Webster. That's the Supreme Court decision, Webster versus Reproductive Health Services, decided in 1989. That upheld a number of restrictions on abortion in Missouri, including prohibiting public resources for abortion care and others. But one of the things I wanted to ask you is, since we're kind of like looking back at the last, almost 50 years, right, is during your lengthy tenure with Planned Parenthood, there was a lot of violence targeting abortion providers, and not just abortion providers, right? If you were a volunteer who was escorting someone to a clinic, if you were someone who was doing work on the front lines to try to make access possible, there were clinics that were bombed. Dr. Barnett Slepian and other physicians were assassinated during your tenure there. And so I guess my first question is, were you scared personally, Gloria, back in those days?
It was challenging. What I learned from that era is that you cannot let terrorists determine the course of your life. You cannot let them change how you live. You cannot let them force you to back off of your values and your belief systems about what women should have. So for me, it really gave me more courage to make sure that any woman who wanted access to reproductive health services of any kind should have access to that. And I was going to find a way for that to happen. We got laws like the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act that makes it a federal crime to conduct that kind of violence against people who are working in the reproductive health field. So there, we got legislative remedies, and we also did a great deal of education of law enforcement officers and city officials and people who, frankly, were doing nothing to protect people, to protect doctors and workers in the clinics, and frankly, the women who wanted to come into the clinics to access reproductive health care. We had to do a lot of educating. So don't think it just happened. Don't think there was just a shift. We had 4 years of an administration that gave cover to people who want to take women's human and civil rights to make their own childbearing decisions away. What we need now is a whole new set of laws. What we need is for people to stand up for, I have a call to action. I mean, I have a really big call to action for all of the women who are now in executive and leadership positions, who have professional positions, women who could not be in those positions if they didn't have the two things that you must have in order to be an equal citizen. You must be able to own and control your own body, and you must be able to earn your own money, have access to financial resources. What I want to urge women to do, and actually men as well, there are many more men now who want to support women's equality, that a positive way to go forward is to put our muscle behind political candidates who pledge to lead the country and their states to pass laws that will secure women's human and civil rights. And that should include passing the Equal Rights Amendment, the Freedom of Choice Act, the Fair Pay Act, policies of that nature, affordable child care is a piece of that. Women business owners, professionals, and those who are in executive positions in large corporations have a special responsibility to do that, because if they didn't have the ability to plan and space their childbearing so that they could actually have economic self-determination, they would never have been able to attain the positions they have, no matter how much they screamed and yelled and picketed in the streets and those kinds of things. I mean, a little street theater can be helpful, but what's more important is to get very involved, understand it's not just about voting once during the elections. It's about supporting policies throughout every single day of our lives. It's about monitoring the media, making sure the media is framing the issues correctly, and not narrowing it down to one narrow issue of abortion, but rather focusing on it's about power. It's about whether women have the power to make their own childbearing decisions. Those are the kinds of things that I call women to do right now.
Why do you think, Gloria, there is such a lack of involvement at the local level, in particularly on issues like reproductive rights, just in terms of local elections in general?
Most people don't pay attention to government at the local level, and those who would like to take away women's human and civil rights to make their own childbearing decisions have been paying attention to who's been elected at the state and local level. And that's one of the reasons why they have more power in those legislatures. So we can do the same thing. We need to understand we can do the same thing, but we have to do it. And hence the title of my book, Intentioning. We can't just think about it. We have to do it.
So, Gloria, I know that you know that I produced a documentary called Reversing Roe that is a history of the various abortion cases that were before the Supreme Court. That's not a shameless plug alert. It's relevant to the conversation today. And one of the things that came up off camera and off the record was some Republicans saying, a lot of us don't want to see Roe v. Wade overturned because it is one of the most powerful tools we have to mobilize voters and to get them to the polls, especially in tight races. So my question is twofold. Do you believe that to be true, that Roe v. Wade itself is safe because from a strategy standpoint, it's too valuable as a get out the vote tool for Republicans? And the second part of that question is, do you see the possibility that these two laws in Texas could similarly end up motivating Democratic voters who may not have been as mobilized on the local level? And not just Democratic voters, but women voters in general.
Yes, Roe has been used as a whipping girl, you could say, to get out voters, particularly certain kinds of voters. That's absolutely true. But we also need to understand that Roe has been pretty much useless for many years. And the only solution is to start where Roe couldn't start. Ruth Bader Ginsburg was right that reproductive rights should be decided as equal protection, not as the right to privacy. So this is why I'm saying we need a different jurisprudence and we need a different set of laws. We need the Freedom of Choice Act that will codify women's right to make their own childbearing decisions. We need the Equal Rights Amendment and we need the Fair Pay Act. Those are things that we need to enable women to be full and complete and equal citizens. And that's where we need to keep our focus.
Can you talk about the real-world consequences as you see it, Gloria, if these laws continue proliferating? To your point, with Roe v. Wade being intact, but there being all of these miscellaneous individual laws at the state level.
Once upon a time, people in the states where abortion was illegal would charter planes or buses or take their cars to take women to other states where they could get a safe legal abortion. That's the prediction that I have. It's the logical conclusion. There will be a certain number of states, it'll be about half and half, where there will be safe legal abortion, and there will be about half of the states where abortion will be fully illegal. And women's lives are at stake, not just in the physical life sense, but in the sense of our life as in the ability to have the life and create the life that we want and deserve to create, to be able to take care of children when we are able to take care of them. I mean, for me, that is the ultimate goal. It's to be able to have children when you can take care of them, when you are able to provide a stable home. That's really what I think everybody would like to see. But it's hard to get from point A to point C in that logical train. This is what will happen. We will have a divided country. And until and unless women have equal power, equal pay, and equal leadership positions, it will just get worse.
I have to tell you on that note, I did not know until I read your book, The War on Choice, that the term barefoot and pregnant came from a real live male elected official
yes.
who had actually said, essentially, I'm paraphrasing here, but he literally said something like, if your wife sticks her nose in things she shouldn't concern herself with, right? You know, whether it's politics or your business, get her a garden to work in. That doesn't work. Get her a cow to milk. And when all else fails, get her pregnant and keep her barefoot and pregnant in the kitchen. And I and others have written previously about the fact that women's participation in American politics and in academia, it's everything you're referring to, increased significantly once the birth control pill and access to legalized abortion became realities. You know, I have friends who are part of the anti-abortion movement from my coverage of the issue over the years, and many of them are very genuine in their religious convictions about this issue. But I have to ask you, if you had to give a stat, like 60% versus 40%, for how many people you believe oppose abortion because they genuinely think it's harmful to women, or that a fetus is a life, versus the number of people who believe that you and I should be home barefoot and pregnant so I'm not on the radio causing trouble and you're not out there in corporate America causing trouble. What do you really think is the divide, Gloria?
Over and over and over again, it's somewhere between 60-40 and 70-30, the higher numbers being people who, regardless of what their religious convictions are, regardless of what they think about abortion per se for themselves, will say that this is not an issue that the government should be mucking around in, that these issues about whether and when you have children should be up to the woman and her conscience, her doctor, her religious faith, her partner in conversation with whoever in her support system can help her make that decision. So if you believe that women have minds, hearts, and consciences, then you believe that women can make these decisions for themselves. And if you believe that every human being on the face of the earth, as I do, should have the opportunity to give their highest and best talents to the world, then you should believe that women should be able to make their own childbearing decisions on their own. There's also, from the perspective of people who have been serving women's reproductive rights, health, and justice on the front lines, they will tell you that that people always believe in the right to choose if it's rape, incest, or me.
Oh, wow.
Because it's that personal. It's that visceral. It's that human element.
Well, you're being gracious, but you talked about this in the book, right? How many people you personally knew of in communities who were publicly against abortion, but you knew were using Planned Parenthood for their daughters. You said something important, though, I want to pick up on. The other thing I learned from your book, Gloria, The War on Choice, which is one of the definitive histories of the reproductive rights movement, you talked about the Clergy Consultation Service Network. And I learned from that that literally it was a consortium of clergy, rabbis, reverends, chaplains who helped women find access to safe abortions before it was legal. And it was actually members of the Clergy Consultation Service. So it was clergy members who helped found the first legal abortion clinic in the country in the state of New York. Gloria, I was fascinated by that in part because the framing of the issue today is so much that religious leaders are opposed to abortion. How did that narrative shift take place?
The narrative shifted because of a strategy that was a pretty smart strategy, and it was a long-term strategy. But really and truly, it's up to those who believe in women's human and civil rights to make their own childbearing decisions, to set the terms of the debate ourselves. It's our job not to argue about the narrow issue of abortion because it is about so much more. It is about power. Mm. It is about who has it, who wields it, and to whose benefit. It is about whether women will have full civil and human rights and an equal place at life's table and the moral authority as well as the legal authority to determine whether and when we will have children. That is part of what women need to take an equal place in leadership. It's part of what women need to be able to earn a living. These are much bigger issues. We can't fault the other side for stating their case. It's up to us to set the terms of the debate and stick with it.
When was the light bulb moment for you that you realized that for women to achieve equality, you couldn't just focus on the reproductive rights movement, couldn't just focus on politics, you couldn't just focus on government, but you needed to take the lead to focus on the big picture of women's leadership and power.
The light bulb moment for me came so many years ago because my work has always been driven by this idea that women deserve to have equality and full equality at all levels and in all different areas of life. So since I was old enough to get involved in community activities, that has been my driving force. So nothing has changed. I have always seen reproductive rights and justice as being this larger picture of women's equality. I decided to take the lead after I realized that we would keep fighting the same battles over and over and over again. It's like Groundhog's Day until and unless women do very clearly take their equal place at life's table and not let anybody put them aside when we have equal leadership roles, equal power, and equal pay, we will be in a much better position to assert the human and civil right to make our own childbearing decisions within that framework. That's why I started to take the lead. And I created a program that helps women understand the power that they have, whether it's in the corporate world, whether it's with their families, or whether it's in politics. In any sector, you need to first understand the power that you have to be able to make that kind of impact in the world. And then the reason I wrote the current book, Intentioning, is because once we know we have the power, we have to answer the question, the power to what?
If there's a woman listening who has more power than she realizes, but she's afraid to use it in her workplace for whatever reason, she's the only woman, she's the only woman of color, she is worried about being seen as too political, what is your advice to her?
She needs to find her support system. If she doesn't have it in her company, she needs to find her support system elsewhere that can help her, give her advice, give her support, help her know how to speak up and when to speak up. and when to pull those levers, and also how to make sure that the company she works in gets more diverse.
Well, as we close, I just want to say I read an article on you in Texas Monthly when I was growing up, and so it's an honor to interview you about your career and your new book, Intentioning. I have people in my own family who disagree on the issue of abortion, but they would all agree that reproductive justice was the pathway out of poverty for our family. I had a grandmother who was one of 14 kids and another who was one of 8, and they struggled. And within a generation in smaller families, we'd made it to the middle class. So it's an important topic, and I'm glad we got a chance to talk about it.
You just gave me goosebumps. Thank you, Kelly.
Let's leave it there for the week. Thank you to my guests, Geraldo Cavava and Gloria Felt. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our production fellow is Nisha Venkat. The show is recorded and mixed by Desmond Taylor and Nick Lamponi. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music, and I'm Kelly Goff. Thanks for joining me, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.